throughout the history of the church, various beliefs, customs, and practices have developed, and the church has developed a language of its own to interpret the meaning of the Christian faith and to explain the theology behind the faith and practice of our religion. I'm reminded of a story of two young boys, one Jewish and the other Christian, who decided to attend one another's worship services. At the synagogue, the Christian boy asked question after question about the unusual language of the prayers, about the giant scrolls from which the rabbi read, and about the fancy candelabra, which he soon discovered was called a menorah. For each of the Christian boy's questions, his Jewish friend explained the meanings and the customs and the names for the various elements of the Jewish service. At the church service, the Jewish boy was equally intrigued with the Christian customs. When the minister welcomed a newborn into the congregation by sprinkling water over the baby's head, the Jewish boy asked, "What does that mean?" His friend explained it meant the church had a new member, and the custom was called baptism. When the minister held up the loaf of bread and broke it, the Jewish boy said, "What does that mean?" His friend explained that it represented the body of Jesus, and it was called communion. Then the preacher approached the pulpit to deliver his sermon. He took off his watch, looked at it, and lay it on the pulpit where he could see it. And the Jewish boy said, "What does that mean?" And his friend answered, "Unfortunately, that don't mean a thing." Well, today, I want to examine some of the language we commonly use in Christianity and see if there are some words which have lost their original meaning and have become as meaningless as that preacher's watch ticking away while the growling stomachs of his restless parishioners long for Sunday dinner. In fact, there may be some words we discover need to be consigned to the scrap heap. The words we'll look at are almighty, sin, salvation, damnation, hell, and incarnation. The first word or words I want to examine is almighty. What does it mean to say that God is almighty? That's a difficult question, and I'm in the process of writing a sermon, it's taken about 6 weeks so far, that deals entirely with that subject. For today, however, I only want to take a brief overview of how divisive this concept is. When we say God is almighty or omnipotent, does that mean that God is in absolute, complete control of everything that ever has or ever will happen? It is amazing how opposed Christians are over this issue. For many, they cannot worship a God who is not in complete control. If the plane crashes, that is God's will. If a child dies of cancer, that is God's will. If an earthquake kills 10,000 people, that is God's will. Protestants who believe this are generally in the Calvinist tradition. Not only is God in control of everything that ever has or ever will happen, God knows ahead of time exactly what is going to happen. Taken to its logical extreme, this means, according to Calvinism, that God knows before a person is born whether or not that person will attain salvation or suffer eternal damnation. For other Christians, the thought of God creating people who are destined for damnation and the idea that God is the cause of all terrible things is no comfort. While the first group of Christians cannot trust a God who is not in complete control of everything, the second group cannot trust a God who causes pain and suffering and tragedy. This second group of Christians believes God is present not as the cause of evil, but as the ultimate and perfect love, which makes bearing evil possible and which ultimately conquers evil in the end. For me, a book entitled The Will of God, written by Leslie D. Weatherhead over 50 years ago, is helpful. Weatherhead holds that God's will can be thought of in three ways: God's intentional will, God's circumstantial will, and God's ultimate will. God's intentional will is that nothing bad ever happen, and that we live joyous and loving lives dedicated to love of God and love of neighbor. But for love to exist, there must be the possibility of refusing to love. It simply isn't love unless we bring it into the world by a conscious decision made in freedom. The freedom designed into the universe means that bad things are possible. And that is where God's circumstantial will takes over. Terrible things happen, but God can act in those terrible circumstances to bring about good. And this is so true. I lived in Oklahoma City when the Murrah Building was bombed and 168 innocent people were killed. In that terrible situation, which I in no way believe was God's intentional will, the people of that community bonded together like they never had before. I've never seen so much love. And that was God's circumstantial will at work. And finally, there is God's ultimate will. The analogy Weatherhead uses is to envision a mountain stream. Let's say it is God's will that the water in that stream reach the bottom of the mountain. Ultimately, it will. A person may build a dam to temporarily undermine that will, or a tree may fall over and block the flow of that water for a time, but ultimately, the water will find its way to the bottom of the mountain. Ultimately, God is in control. In spite of the way God's intentional will is thwarted by the freedom designed into the world. And just as the water in that stream will ultimately reach its intended destination, we human beings will go through life, occasionally diverted, but ultimately reaching our ultimate destination, which is God's loving embrace. That's all I'm going to say on this subject for now. But it's fair to say you may expect a more detailed message about what it means for God to be almighty in the future. Perhaps almighty is not a word we need to throw on the scrap heap, but I believe it is certainly a word we should start using with care. The next word I want to look at is sin. Paul Tillich, probably the greatest of the 20th century theologians, believed that this is one of those words we could probably do better without. It's not that there's no such thing as sin, it's just that the word itself has lost its meaning. Tillich said we should use another word like estrangement in place of the word sin. Most of us don't think of ourselves as sinners. I mean, if any one of us was asked to give five words which describe us as a human being, I doubt if anybody here is going to list sinful as one of those words. And I seriously doubt if any of us has ever done our Jimmy Swaggart imitation saying, "I'm a vile, terrible sinner." Of course, we haven't just been caught being naughty with some lady of the evening. And that's the problem with the word sin. We think it has something to do with being naughty. And it probably has something to do with sex. After all, what is naughtier than sex? But that's not the original meaning of the word sin. Sin is a condition of human existence. We need to begin with this simple statement: God is perfect. We aren't. And we cannot be one with God because we are not perfect. Tillich has a great way of describing sin. He said it is the tendency to want more for ourselves than an objective examination of our place in the universe would warrant. In plain language, we have a tendency to look out for number one. We have a tendency to love and care for ourselves more than we do for others. It's a condition we all share. It's part of being human. And until we acknowledge that condition until we acknowledge the fact that as human beings we are sinful, we cannot appreciate the heart of the Christian message, namely, that God loves us in spite of our sin. So sin may be one of those words we really do need to get rid of, just excise it from the English language, because we need to replace it with the word we can all agree describes the nature of the human condition. Sin? I don't think so, because that word, for whatever reason, tends to make us snicker, and the condition it describes is far, far from funny. In fact, the condition it describes is the reason for the next word I want to examine, salvation. If each of us in this sanctuary this morning was to write down on a piece of paper what we thought the word salvation means, we would get as many answers as there are people. Most of us would say it has something to do with an afterlife. You may be surprised to learn that the vast majority of theologians in the world today do not believe salvation has anything to do with afterlife. The word salvation comes from the root word salve and has to do with healing. Salvation is a spiritual healing. Salvation is the overcoming of sin, the overcoming of estrangement, the overcoming of our separation from God. In the Gospels, Jesus continually talks about the kingdom of heaven, but he almost never talks about it in a future sense. He does not deny that there is a future beyond the grave. In fact, he specifically says he is going to prepare a place for those who follow him. But when Jesus discusses the kingdom of heaven, it is always in the sense that it is a present reality, right here, right now. We are to enter eternal life right now. You will remember that the Sadducees, who did not believe in the resurrection, tried to stump Jesus by asking if a woman's husband dies and she marries another man, which one will be her husband in heaven? Jesus says, there will be no marriage in heaven. It's different. And that's all he says about it. Now think about this for a moment. I have just told you everything Jesus of Nazareth ever said about the afterlife. He indicated it's there and it's different. That's it. That's the beginning and the end of the teachings of Jesus on the afterlife. It is almost hard to believe that from the teachings of that man, we have devised a religion that is often so obsessed with the afterlife, it overlooks the gift of life in this world, all the while dreaming of some heavenly future beyond the grave, which obviously was not of great concern to Jesus himself. And so if we are thinking of salvation in some way that has to do with living on and on and on in some cartoon-like afterlife where we lounge around on fluffy clouds and listen to harp music, we may need to get rid of that word or at least rethink how we use it. Our salvation is a free and undeserved gift. We have a simple choice to make. We can either say yes or no to a relationship with God. If we say yes, we have our salvation. Because if we enter into a relationship with God, God will not forsake us. And we will try to live our lives as followers of Jesus, even in our sinful, estranged state. We will try to build God's kingdom here on earth, and we will trust God to take care of what comes after. We can't do anything about that anyway. And if we say no to God, what then? Well, the result might be a couple of those words I want to examine, words that most of us would certainly love to see eliminated from our language: damnation and hell. First, let me tell you something I believe with all my heart. There is no such thing as eternal damnation. The whole idea is bad theology, because God alone is eternal. The idea of eternal damnation means that there is a second eternal power, an evil power, that will never be overcome. God and the devil at war forever and ever. That is not my religion, and I certainly hope it is not yours. So if that is what we think of when we hear the word damnation, then it's a word we should toss onto the scrap heap. Damnation is consignment to hell. To be damned is to be in hell. And while I told you I do not believe in eternal damnation, let me say just as assuredly, I do believe in hell. And like the kingdom of heaven, it exists right here, right now. Many theologians believe, and I agree with them, so they must be right, that hell is not a place. Hell is a condition. Hell is separation from God. Now, while our sinful nature makes us estranged from God, we can still be in a relationship with God if we open ourselves to God's love. But in our freedom, we are capable of saying a radical no to God. We are free to live our lives for the sole purpose of self-gratification. We can entirely eliminate love from our lives. And when we do, this world becomes hell. So while the kingdom of heaven and the condition of hell both exist here and now in this world, only the kingdom of heaven is eternal. I know this because I trust God, and I believe that any power hell maintained in this world was ultimately crushed by the last word I want to discuss this morning, the incarnation. The incarnation is the idea that God became incarnate. God became human. Many people, myself included, have found this idea to be almost impossible to swallow because of the way it has been presented to us. We have been told that Jesus and God are exactly the same thing. But how can we, as intelligent 20th century people, be asked to believe that a man, Jesus of Nazareth, who lived 2,000 years ago, was God? You and I know that, as near as scientists can tell, the Big Bang occurred about 15 billion years ago. If that was the beginning, and who knows, we may be just one of millions of universes, each beginning with its own Big Bang. But if that was the beginning, are we to believe that some 5-foot, 7-inch man, Jesus of Nazareth, was present at that time as the creator of the universe? No, if the idea of the incarnation is going to make any sense, it has to be looked at in a different way. It just doesn't make sense to say God and Jesus are exactly the same thing. What the incarnation means to me is simple. The human mind is simply incapable of grasping the mystery of God. God is unknowable. But by looking at Jesus, we can understand God. We can actually know the nature of God by looking at the nature of Jesus. For those of you who were here on Christmas Eve, you've heard my reflection on the incarnation, but there's a part of that message I want to repeat this morning because I believe it is so vitally important to understanding what the Christian faith is about, at least in my life. While Christianity has become weighted down with doctrines and creeds, I do not believe they are essential to our faith. I have just a few beliefs on which my faith is anchored, and I treasure them. Primary among my cherished beliefs is this: before God created the universe, God's redemptive love was present. Before a single being was created anywhere in the universe with the freedom to move away from God's perfection, God's healing, redeeming, and forgiving love was already there, offering salvation. And as I said on Christmas Eve, that is a reasonable idea. God's redemptive love being present before creation makes sense. considering God's loving mercy. But beyond that, my heart has reached a conclusion that is simply beyond my reason. I believe that redemptive love became incarnate. That perfect love came to be perfectly reflected in a human being. Jesus of Nazareth, I believe, was transparent to God's love. The sinful selfishness, which is a part of every other human being, was simply not a part of Jesus. And that is why we may call him the incarnation of God. Well, theology is fun stuff, isn't it? I suppose what makes it so appealing to me is the mystery of God which underlies theology. There's no way for anybody to say with absolute assurance that they have come upon the ultimate true way to approach religion. But as we examine the meaning of the words that have shaped our faith, I know we can learn and grow together. And sincerely, I hope you all know how much I appreciate being on this faith journey with such a wonderful group of loving people. You are the best of traveling companions.